Thank you very much, and I'm very aware of two things. One, it's the last session of the first day, and number two, I'm the only thing standing between you and free beer. So here we go. Yes, I'm a system administrator. I have been for my entire career. I've done other things at the same time. I've been a developer, I've done security research, but I've always been a sysadmin, and hopefully this will help you be a sysadmin too. So we are a culture of storytellers. From the earliest mainframes, from the beginning of programming, from the beginning of time, we've had this oral tradition. That's why we have great epic poems. People remember stories. If you remember the most important IT sysadmin lessons you ever learned, you probably either learned them from someone who told you a story, or you had an epic fail, and now you tell the story. That's just the way our minds work. We think about, we remember stories, and we don't remember checklists, because if we did, we wouldn't have to write them down. So I'm going to tell you some campfire stories, and at the end, I have some lessons from all of the, from what I've learned. I'll warn you now, there are two brief mentions of cases involving child exploitation, and there's a little PG-13 language, so fair warning. I want to thank the program committee for inviting me back. The last time I was in Washington, D.C. was for Usenix Security, 15 August 2001. Things have changed a little bit. George W. Bush was in the White House. We were still arguing about triple DES. AES was new, and everybody was looking for the NSA backdoors. Matt Blaze and I had just given a congressional testimony the year before about the FBI's carnivore program. We were talking about retail-level surveillance. Now we're talking wholesale-level surveillance. Room 641A, Patriot, Patriot 2, Iraq, Afghanistan, all these things were in our future. And Snowden was way off in the future, and no one really saw that one coming. Enron was still around. So was Sun Microsystems. We had LiveJournal. MySpace was still in the future. The BlackBerry 850 had just shipped. iBooks still looked like toilet seats. The iPhone was 5 years away. At Usenix Security that week, we were talking about Electronic Communications Privacy Act and what this meant as, in terms of storage for system administrators. We were talking about the security of Palm OS. The keynote address was web-enabled gadgets. Can we trust them? A few weeks later, a little startup called Google was awarded a patent for something called PageRank. And some people still thought that Comic Sans was a great idea. This was actually the official template of the San Diego Supercomputer Center in 2001. Comic Sans was the standard. We've come a long way, I hope. So why am I here again? It's 15 years later. Things have changed. Law enforcement's gotten better. We've gotten better. The posture has changed, national security issues. I'm mostly talking about law enforcement issues, not national security, but I may wander into that topic. I've had more interactions with law enforcement. Most have been good, a few bad. I have some lessons there. And why am I here? I want to help you be prepared when you either get that call from your CEO or your CIO or someone saying, we've been hacked, or the FBI calls and said, did you know you've been hacked? Or you need to call someone and tell them we've been hacked. So here we go. Some rules. You'll learn you never, ever talk about active cases. So anything that's happened in the last 2 years, I really can't talk about. There's a lot been going on. You may have heard of some things around Sony. Not going to talk about those today. You always protect sources and methods. You always protect the people who give you the information. You protect how you got it. You always get competent legal advice, which probably isn't your legal department. Odds are very good that your legal department is full of lawyers who are probably really, really good at intellectual property law and contracts, and they probably don't have any background in criminal law at all. So competent legal advice doesn't mean that your lawyers are incompetent, it just means that they aren't criminal lawyers. And finally, I don't speak for any current or former employer, and I've never been a lawyer. So we're sysadmins, so we actually have a better campsite, you know, we have a better campfire. And so I'm gonna tell you a couple of stories and then talk about the lessons. In the beginning, there were these guys. 1995 was my first case. A guy named Kevin Mitnick, you may have heard of him. He had a friend Satoma Shimomura. They had a discussion, it didn't go well. There are three books and a movie on this case, and none of them match my recollections or email trails. If you read the books, there's a Tom mentioned in there, It's a different Tom. There were four Toms and four contiguous offices. I'm fortunately not in there. My job was to make sure that the director knew where Sutomo and Andrew Gross were, because one was an employee and the other was a grad student who worked for me. And the university kind of really wanted to know where people were. So lesson one, make sure your management and your lawyers know what you're up to. My involvement was making sure we knew where they were, what they were up to, and then I handled all of the subpoena requests for all the data, so all the logs. I also got this book out of it, and I have the only copy of Takedown in the world that's signed by both Sutomo Shimomura and Kevin Mitnick. Kevin didn't think much about the book. At the same time, while Kevin was on the run, before he was found, our NOC got a call one night from Secret Service Special Agent Stevens, working out of the Denver office. He was in hot pursuit of Kevin Mitnick and could catch him at any moment if he could speak to Sutomo Shimomura and could I give him his phone number. The NOC called me, I called back, I got Special Agent Stevens' phone number from them, made the call. I had no way of identifying this person, so I called the Secret Service office in Denver. They close at 5 p.m. I tried the San Diego Secret Service office. They close at 4:30. Did you know that you can get the 24-hour watch office of the Secret Service in Washington, D.C. from information? They're open 24 hours. They won't tell you anything. So after 3 hours, I could not verify who this guy was. And finally, I said, you know what? I don't know you, and you'll have to find another way. Call me Monday. Later, I actually talked to our local bureau and Secret Service and found out that they would have made contact through a local person that I knew, or that we could visit them, or we could call them at their office. So that was lesson one. Call them, know them. Found out later that we were the star attraction of the social engineering contest at DEF CON that year. There was a person standing in a phone booth on a stage with me for several hours trying to get Sutomo Shimomura's phone number. So I didn't find this out until about 10 years later, but apparently there's YouTube around. I've never seen it. So how will you be contacted by law enforcement? In person, someone you know, or you can call them, but don't listen to Special Agent Stevens. 1998, anybody remember what happened? Who was hacking for girlies? Biggest web defacement of its day. New York Times is hacked, right? New York Times is hacked by hacking for girlies because Kevin Mitnick is being unlawfully incarcerated and they're in support, right? So at about the same time, we had a Unix workstation at the lab that was compromised. So we're doing forensics on this and blah, blah, blah. And I get a call from someone I know at the local San Diego FBI office who says, you should call this guy in New York. I call this guy in New York, and it's a special agent out of the New York office who's working the New York Times case. And he says, your IP addresses came up while we're doing forensics on the website. Do you have any logs or backups or anything? And I said, yes. And he said, would you please save them? Okay, I saved them, they went in the safe, and every year on the anniversary of that call, he would call me up and say, do you still have the tape? This case is still active, and do you still have it? And I said, sure I do. Around 2003, he stopped calling. I'm guessing he retired, I don't know. It's no longer an active case, but if you're really bored and you can find a 4mm DAT drive, I can give you the evidence. The chain is broken, so there's no chain of custody, but if you want to go for it, I've got the tape, and go and have fun. It's been in my desk drawer as several safes over the last 15 years. Towards the end of the 90s, I worked on some child pornography cases. There was not a lot of forensics ability in law enforcement at the time, and they were running into a lot of remote things that before it had been floppy drives and CDs and things passed around. Now we're seeing this information transferred over the internet, and they were running into problems. What's a chat log? How does FTP work? What do these logs mean? And in both of these cases, the claim was that evil hackers had put the file on the suspect's hard drive. They were never able to explain how they had put it on there or how it could ever have happened, but that was always their claim. In the first case, digital evidence led to physical evidence, which led to a conviction. In the second case, the evil hackers struck again, but there were files and chat logs. The chat logs had someone, maybe evil hackers, we were never sure, saying, I'm going to go to Fry's tomorrow because this big hard drive, I have so many images, and this big hard drive is on sale at this price. Okay, pulled the computer, Guess what model hard drive it had in it? Guess what was in the filing cabinet? The receipt for the hard drive from Fry's for the model at the price on the date. So digital evidence led to physical evidence, led to a conviction. There were also 30,000 images on his computer, including images of his daughter. So that kind of proved that it wasn't the evil hackers. He was convicted and is still in custody and probably will be for another 20 years. He was part of an international CP ring that was working in 30 countries, and I think they said eventually over 100 victims were identified. Most worthwhile use of my time I can remember. Around the same time, I had some other interactions with law enforcement that weren't quite as good. Remember, your goals are not their goals. Your goals may be to clean up, to protect your company, to recover your data. Law enforcement may have goals of make the case, make the career. So you have to make sure that you know what you want and what they want. So only once, twice in 20 years have I ever had a problem. So this guy on the left looks pretty trustworthy to me. I'm sure I've seen his picture somewhere before. He's probably out there somewhere. Does anybody know who the guy on the right is? Who is it? Well, the guy on the left is. The guy on the right? Yeah, it's Mulder on the left. Anybody know the guy on the right? That's right, that's Robert Hansen. He was a FBI special agent who spied for the Soviet Union and Russia from 1979 to 2001 while he was leading the counterintelligence unit that was supposed to be keep spying on them. So the lesson is, you trust people you know trust people who have built trust with you, you don't trust organizations. Around 2000, I helped create a local organization called the San Diego Regional Info Watch. We were worried that local or some law enforcement might be showing up and seizing, you know, boatloads of computers from our university. This was happening. Secret Service, FBI in some cases, Customs were rolling up, and we think there's something here, so we're going to seize all the computers in the university department. We kind of figured that if we knew these guys and we had some kind of relationship with them, that they might actually call us and we might help them figure out which one computer to take. So we created the Regional Info Watch, 80% academic and industry, and 20% law enforcement. And this was kind of the beginning of the cooperation in San Diego. Later, I joined HTCIA, High Tech Crime Investigation Association. If you're involved in high tech crime, you should definitely join. It's 80% law enforcement, 20% industry. And then also InfraGuard is also a great place to meet people who care about critical infrastructure protection, security, intellectual property. So these groups are really great for meeting the people that someday you may need, or that someday may need you. So remember, we're talking about networking and relationships. So many of the people I met through these groups, I still stay in contact with. Our kids grew up together. Strangely enough, my kids grew up playing D&D with agents from FBI, NCIS, Sheriff, and Regional Computer Forensics Lab, which is you get some really strange D&D games when you've got that going on. But do I trust the people that I met? Some of them I trust completely. I absolutely trust them completely. Do I trust the organizations? No, because organizations have rules and organizations have agendas. At about the same time, the FBI created a project called Regional Computer Forensics Lab. So there are about a dozen labs around the country, and they process digital evidence for the Bureau, for federal law enforcement, and also for local law enforcement. And so since forensics was really new, I helped provide some of the training. And in exchange, I got to attend all the training that they did. So I got to meet some really interesting people and take a couple of really cool courses. This is the course on how to talk to defectors, which is also really good for interviewing skills, which makes it easier to hire really good sysadmins later in life. Early 1999. This was not my case, but I had a peripheral involvement, and it reinforces the idea of relationships matter. So I think it was probably 3 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and I got a call from some friends who worked at a local high-tech company in San Diego, and they said, we've been hacked. One of them had actually taken my digital forensics course, so we'd known each other for quite a number of years at this point, and we've been hacked. We've known about it, we've been investigating for a week, but legal wouldn't let us call anybody. And here it is on Saturday morning, and they've told us we can call someone. We've got a pretty good suspect. Who do we call? who do you call at 3 a.m. on a Saturday morning? And in my case, I called two agents that I played D&D with and said, hey, I've got these friends. Let me give you each other's, you know, let me give you each other's phone numbers and you two kind of talk amongst yourselves, right? And for 2 years, I never heard anything. And then in 2001, Skate, the Los Alamos hacker, Jerome Heckenkamp, was arrested and charged. And in 2004, he pled out and was sentenced to time served. So this case ran about 5 years. There are several other people, some of whom I see in the audience, who actually know the entire story. I don't. For me, this was about, I had two friends, I had two groups of friends who needed to talk to each other, and relationships matter. In 2003, I went on sabbatical. So since 2003, I've never had a job description that included the word security. But a few things have happened along the way. I work for a video game company, and I was hired to grow the IT department. We launched online games for PlayStation 2, which you may remember. That's the olden days, right? Dial-up and Ethernet. Over those years, we've seen a lot of smaller cases. Our employees monitor public chat rooms and forums looking for gameplay cheats. In PS2, cheat devices. For PS3, attempts to crack the microkernel. They're looking for all kinds of this stuff. And occasionally, we run into things, other kinds of materials. So we've run into threats against schools, DDoS, DDoS for hire, online bomb threats against us, video game companies, run into all this stuff. But because we have phone numbers that we can call, we've been able to get this information into the hands of law enforcement relatively quickly. In one of these cases, we got the information from us to the FBI in San Diego, to the legal attaché in Ireland, to the Garda, and they interviewed the student the next morning before he went to school. So, and it was a credible threat. The kid really needed some help. So this is the kind of stuff that if you hang out on public forums, you will see this. It's nice to know that there's someone you can call, someone who knows that you have, you know, a certain amount of credibility and you can give them usable information. If you've gotten the impression that this has all been one way, you know, nothing but helping law enforcement, we've gotten a lot back. We've had cases where we just had this case XYZ and we found copies of your source code. That was nice. You know, something XYZ is coming, or there's a new attack vector. We're going to announce it through InfraGuard in 48 hours. You might want to take a look and batten down the hatches now. We knew about NTP reflection about 4 weeks before the news came out, so we were battening down the hatches. So we've gotten a lot of this information from InfraGuard. A lot of it's come from personal contacts. So it has not all been one way. Also, I got to hang out with the behavioral research unit in Quantico for an afternoon and talk about the psychology of hackers. And I learned so much, and I think they learned a little bit, but they also let me shop at the gift shop, so it hasn't all been all one way. But this is the thing. It's not about who are you going to call when you need help, but who can you help, and that's what makes it all work. So I do have one case that I want to talk about that sums up everything. It's not a modern case because you never talk about active cases and so much is still going on. There's still people we're looking for. There's still convictions that we hope will happen sometime in the next few years. This is a case, DDoS against SOCOM, which is one of our PlayStation 2 titles, SOCOM 2 and SOCOM 3. This case has been written up a couple of places. It's finally was been released publicly. It's been a Gartner white paper, and the Bureau uses this in some of their training. They also use this as an example for going out and talking to large companies and talk about how to be a good victim and how to be prepared. So it started with a simple DDoS in 2008, and it went a few places from there. So 2008, online games are new. I mean, online games are really new. We launched PlayStation 2 online gaming in 2002, 2003. So in 2008, they've been around a while, and games are really big. Anybody know this chart? Anybody know who wrote this? USENIX, well-known USENIX person? Bill Cheswick and Kada created this about 8 years ago, I think. But online games are real-time simulation. Milliseconds matter. From the time a person mashes a button on a console through the internet, to the server, through the physics engine, through the anti-cheat, back through the internet, back to the console to get graphically rendered, we have under 100 milliseconds. So real time matters to us. And at this time, we were running about 8,000 game servers worldwide, dev and test, and each title could have between 10 and 500 servers against a single, running behind a single title. And there's physics engines and lobbies and all kinds of stuff, and the titles were per region. So everything I'm talking about is PS2, nothing about PS3, nothing PSN, nothing PS4, but the principles still apply. Because what happens if you have a really hot knock, which we do, they say, hey, we just dropped some servers, you know, what happened? And they start investigating, and it always happens at 3 a.m., I don't know why. SOCOM 2 is one of our older titles. It was 5 years old at this point, but it was still really popular. It had tens and tens and tens of thousands of players every night. This was the first title I ever worked on, so it's a very special place in my heart. And the title was running at about 150 servers, so we could drop 5 or 10 or 15 servers at a time, and then we would just wait for the maintenance window and restart. But this is not supposed to happen unless there's a software update, because, you know, 80% of outages are self-inflicted, and we didn't self-inflict. So we knew there was something going on, so we started looking at it, and then we got busy. So in that fall, we had our first real full year of PlayStation 3. So we launched some of the largest titles we've ever had, Gran Turismo, Resistance, Little Big Planet, and yet another SOCOM title. I think by the end of the franchise, we'd done 10 of them. But between supporting the developers and launching, you know, a completely new online game technology, we were a little bit busy. So we kind of forgot about the DDoS in February. And then in November, it was like deja vu all over again, because, hey, you know, we just dropped a bunch of servers, and wait, you know, it just crashed, and was there a software update? And no, there wasn't. And so, you know, this time we had a little breathing room, so they called the sysadmins, and, you know, we were running, SOCOM 3 was running 250 servers, and we were dropping like 5 to 10 or 15 at a time a couple of nights, and this is not supposed to happen because the gameplay experience is the most important thing. So obviously we have a problem. And so what we found was we had a SYNFLED denial of service coming, only 40 IP addresses, so by modern standards, not a lot, but we're talking 2008, you know, 100 megabit connections to servers, and this is going on for quite a while. We mitigate the attack, we write a summary for management, and we go back to bed. But it keeps coming back, and it goes on through November, and it keeps coming back larger and larger and larger, and we're doing things with IP tables and firewalls. So at one point, we just started taking, you know, we're just gonna knock out the /24, boom, boom, boom. All the servers are in Europe. All of the attackers are in Europe, ISP. So we start knocking out, like, you know, France Telecom, okay, you got a bad 24, you know, and finally we start blocking, like, /11s. And at one point, we just said, you know what? Well, sorry, so if you were a SOCOM player in Germany, Spain, France, Italy in 2008, I'm sorry, because we just blocked entire countries. There was just no other way around it. We started blocking like /8s everywhere until we could get some mitigation in place, and we put in some auto detection and some IP table update rules. So the system is starting to get back to sleep, but this is not supposed to happen. Our gamers are not having a good time, so not acceptable. So we start looking at it and trying to figure out what's going on. DDoSes were happening, but you know, DDoSes were usually DOSes. DDoSes was still kind of new, and all this stuff is coming from Europe. We don't have European players. All our players are supposed to be in the US region. The European players should be playing on the European servers, and they're not seeing this problem. And they're real sources. It's not spoofed IP addresses. You know, Nmap says, yep, this is an unpatched Windows box. It says it's a Windows box. And the attacker always bugs us at night, our time. So they never start before about 4:30, 4 p.m., you know, when school gets out. Maybe have homework due on Monday because they never bother us beyond about 8 p.m. Eastern on Sunday night. They'll attack from anywhere from 20 to 30 or even 100 hosts, and then you know they'll go away. And we're trying to figure out what's going on. Why is the attack coming from Europe? But yet the attacker behavior looks like U.S. East Coast, and we're seeing you know only 30 to 50 megabits of traffic. And then later we start seeing 220 megabits. Today we don't even worry about that. But this is 220 megabits aimed at a single Dell 1650, which doesn't work. So what's going on? And well, yeah, actually it's a baby botnet. This is actually a Sony Curio robot, which Sony did as a research project. They're like 2 feet tall and they walk and they dance. There's some scary, scary, scary YouTube video of these things dancing. So it looks like we've got a botnet in Europe with someone on the East Coast owning it. And we're seeing 60 megabits, 100 megabits, 220 megabits, and it comes and it goes. And so we get to the point that our automated responses, we're blocking the IPs, we're blocking 24s, and we're getting better at it. But by the end of November, we're doing pretty good. I mean, we're not dropping, 20,000 players every time there's an attack. And the system men start to get more sleep, and we start to, start feel a little bit better, but this is not acceptable. Someone is messing with our gamers. So there's other stuff going on. So this is also another thing you're going to want to think about. Make sure your management knows what you're doing, make sure your lawyers know what you're doing, and make sure that they know everything that you're doing all the time. Keep them fully apprised. So every morning we're doing a report. X number of thousands of gamers were knocked offline. X number of servers were knocked offline. It looks like it came from 500 sources in these five countries. And these are reports that we're generating every morning, all the way up to our VP of important things. And also we're sending them off to the, the lawyer paladin. So they know everything that's going on, and they know what we're doing, and more importantly, they know what we're not doing. And we're having this discussion about, we're going to find something, and when we do, we're going to want to call the FBI, and we want you to be ready. We were very, very lucky that the head of our legal department at that time was a former assistant district attorney. So between him going, oh yeah, and the VP of important things going, this is not acceptable, we had an awful lot of support. But something really wonderful happened. Remember that whole thing about protecting sources and methods? We discovered the in-game nickname of a suspect. We used that nickname to track all of that person's logins and all of their IP addresses for the prior year. So we get all of that, we find all their logins, IP addresses, we create software alerts to page and email us with their source IP every time they join the game so we can keep an eye on what's going on. We identify two other suspects that they're always, the three of them are always in private games, so there's something interesting going on there. And we identify game signatures. A game signature is the serial number, the physical serial number of the console and the physical serial number of the disk hashed together to make a unique signature. And so we can all, we will be able to match, if we ever get them, the console and the disks and the combinations to see what's going on. So what we discovered is that people who are friends in games, well, first of all, people tend to use the same nickname everywhere. So if they are Admin Angel in our game, odds are really good that they're Admin Angel on MySpace or some other social media network, and probably their three other friends are probably using the same nickname in social media. And PageRank, Google, right? Life is good. So, yeah, and by the way, if your name is Admin Angel and you change your account to Legna Nimda, boy, we're never going to figure that one out. And it really helps when you take a screenshot of your DDoS tool and it's got our IP addresses in the attack and the little attack in progress button is lit. Thank you very much. That kind of stuff helps. But this is really weird because we've got multiple signatures. We're seeing what looks like multiple consoles, multiple disks. Why is this coming if it's a person? Why does it look like we've got a whole bunch of consoles going on? And also, there's one set of IP addresses from Monday through Friday and a second set of IP addresses on Saturdays and Sundays, always, every single time. So we're not quite sure what's going on there. So we're getting close. Finally, we have those people who are patrolling, online game sites and forums and everything. They also monitor chat, our chat, perfectly. If you read the EULA, you'll know that we are allowed to, and plus we have vulgarity figures to keep 8-year-olds from typing words, certain words at each other. And so our in-game patrollers are watching this guy, and here comes the PG-13 language. So we've got 3 male voices and 2 female voices, and it goes something like this. Hey, my bitches, watch this! And a lobby goes offline. Okay, that wasn't cool. And then, voice number 2 says, how about US East lobby number 3? And it goes, sure, why not? And it's gone. And there's this female giggling in the back. So I guess chicks dig hackers? I don't know. But it's always these same 3. And so we've got them in voice chat calling out the names of the servers and the names of the lobbies, and then they go offline 30 seconds later. We're pretty sure we got the right one. So we call the ISP, and they had a great team. We contact the ISP, and they look at it, and they say right away, we're going to turn this guy off right now because he's violating we're going to violate our terms of service. He's rolling his IP constantly, and we got a whole bunch of other stuff going on in this account, so we're going to turn it off. It's like, no, please, not yet. Don't do that. We're happy that you could turn him off. If you wouldn't mind as a favor to us, let's wait until the next time the attack comes, and then you can do whatever it is you want to do, ISP. We're not telling you to do anything. Let's see what happens. And so Anybody know what this is? Does everybody know what this is? Ether killer, a modern European ether killer, actually. So we want additional confirmation to make sure we know that we've got the right one, because we do not want to be accusing anyone. All we've said to the ISP is, we're seeing suspicious traffic, and they say, TOS violation. Okay, let's go a little bit farther. So 2 p.m. Sunday, Sunday afternoon before Thanksgiving, yay, no holidays for us. Everything happens, everybody's on a conference call, the attacks start, and they call the ISP and say, you know, we're seeing suspicious traffic, we don't know what you're gonna do, but do whatever it is you feel like doing. And the ISP says, yeah, we turned off the service at both cable modems. Wait, what? What do you mean, two cable modems? We only know about one. But remember that whole IP hopping thing? There's something going on. So when this guy gets booted, the other two are still in game chat, and they're talking amongst themselves about this information they're getting from suspect number one via IRC. So we're pretty sure we've got a good handle. So far, we've done nothing but protect our own systems. We've only investigated our own systems. We've not involved law enforcement in any way. Our legal team's involved, our management's involved, and then Monday happens. So we call the FBI, and we said, hi, remember that thing that we said a couple months ago we might want to talk to you about? And I said, yeah, but that was like months ago. I said, yeah, come on down. And so we turned over, you know, DVDs, 18 gigs of log data, an incredible sysadmin, guy passed by Hockey Geek. Yeah, he did 18 pages of 11-point notes, spreadsheets on how much it had cost us to investigate and mitigate. So we gave them like this package, and they like, wow, thanks. And then later we found out, they said, yeah, this is the largest single data dump we've ever gotten at an initial interview. Usually we have to go back and ask for information. You gave us everything. And this actually came from their postmortem, and this comes from their training. They said that they had enough to go get the warrant based on the information we gave them in that 1 hour meeting. So life is good, right? So the guy's gone, FBI's gonna do the FBI thing, and so we're good, no new attacks, right? Everything's happy, kitties, unicorns, rainbows, all that. But you know it's gonna happen, right? Because it always happens when it gets quiet and everybody runs into the garage full of chainsaws, and you know that something's gonna happen. So in December 2008, the guy's back. We never turned off his accounts. We wanted to make sure that if he ever came back, we'd know, we could watch. And the attack profile changes. He switches some techniques. We reload the IP frag, and we turn on all the automated stuff again, and we go back to sleep. And okay, and we get through Christmas. Christmas is a big time for us. Do you know how many PlayStations are under Christmas trees and how many show up online for the very first time? All of them. So Christmas morning is really important to us, okay? And then in January, at this point, the DDoS stuff just isn't working. We're fighting that off pretty good. And so he moves to the application level. Remember that stuff I said where we have a vulgarity filter to filter out dirty words? Well, he found a magic packet that triggered a buffer overflow in that it was a commercial library. So we had to go get the people who created the library, could you please fix your library so our service doesn't crash? They did that, and then he went after the load balance servers, so we reconfigured the load balancers. And then at the end of January, probably right around spring breaky kind of time, it got quiet. It got quiet. We didn't see anything for a couple of weeks. And then in March, they're back, right? Because they're always going to come back. And he's bragging to his friends online, and I'm up at the game developer conference in San Francisco in a conference room, and we're part of this discussion with the VP is like, how much is this costing us? And I get this call, and they say, oh yeah, we just picked him up. Unfortunately, he's in high school, but we got computers, we got consoles, we got disks, we got everything. And they found, two or three consoles, they found, I think 10 or 15 SOCOM disks, which explains a lot of the stuff, and two locations. So they picked him up at the high school, and then they served warrants at both of the homes. Why is a kid in one place Monday through Friday and somewhere else on the weekends? Divorced parents, exactly. We did all the combinations of all the consoles and all the disks, and we came up with every single game signature that was in our logs. So that made it really easy. But it's still happening, right? But it only happens when suspects number 2 and 3 are around. And we kind of guessed that they were trying to build an alibi, you know, like, it can't be me because you guys have all my computers, so obviously it's not me. Then the FBI interviewed the kid again, and I guess they decided it probably wasn't the best thing for him. And we're also getting questions from the Bureau, like, what is a game signature, and how does this console? So they're pulling forensics chat logs and other cool things and attack tools off. And did you know that the GUI-driven DDoS tools keep logs? Apparently they do, because they had logs. So they're asking us questions. We're just answering technical questions about what, we don't know what they're finding. They're just saying, do you know this IP address? What's a game signature? All this stuff. And then September, you know, things, he kind of realized that this was not going to go away. We have a couple more meetings, but we're not getting anything from the forensics. We have no idea what they're finding on the guy's computer. They're just asking us a bunch of questions about, you know, PlayStation technology. So he's a juvenile, right? The FBI did the investigation, so what happens? Well, it turns out that in Pennsylvania, there is a high-tech crime unit attached to the sheriff's office. And so the FBI went to and said, would you like a Christmas present? And the guy was charged in state court. He thought he was going to get off. Dad, I think I heard Dad was a lawyer, civil lawyer. But when the prosecuting attorney went, brump, and said, oh, by the way, 15 felonies, and we've got you on all of them, and basically we're tired of messing with you, he pled guilty to 5. So he pled to 5. Juveniles are not convicted, actually. They're adjudicated delinquent, and they are remanded to custody because the federal government doesn't have any place to put juveniles. And in Pennsylvania, they're not convicted because they're not of age, so they can't be guilty, so they're delinquent. But it also turns out that felony convictions in Pennsylvania as a juvenile are not sealed. You know, in high school, and they said, this is going on your permanent record? This is what could happen. Your teachers were right. This is what could happen, right? So we're done, right? Bad guy's gone away, tax have stopped, you know, life is good, PS3's out, and things are good, right? So here we are, 2 years later, August 2002, number two, Neo to Remember, was arrested. The case against him was even stronger because they pulled all the logs from Admin Angel's computer. I don't even know who these guys are. I just know their handles. And when they pull the computers, they arrest him and his father. He's 22, I think, and the father was whatever. And the computers contained contraband images. Let's just leave it at that. And we don't hear anything else. You know, August 2002, summer. And then a year later, Neo 2 pleads out. He pleads to several felonies involving all kinds of things, including destruction of data in federal court. The father was convicted on child porn charges and remanded. So it's all over, right? God, I hope so, because this has been going on, you know, we're now going on, you know, 7-8 years, but we still know that suspect number 3 is out there, and we also know that this case, these guys were part of a larger group. They attacked every 3-letter agency of the U.S. government except the FBI, so CIA and NSA included, and for some reason, they really had a thing for the Mounties because they were attacking the RCMP as much or more than everybody else. So that's that story. So I told you all those stories so that I wouldn't have to give you walls of text, but some walls come. Lessons. What have I learned from all of this? If you don't remember anything about any of this, this is the slide. Relationships matter. It's relationships with your team. It's the relationships with your legal, with your management, and maybe law enforcement if that helps, but relationships matter because you have to decide who you're going to trust. You're going to have to bring some people in legal and management up to speed. You may have to bring law enforcement up to speed if you have a strange and weird technology like game consoles. But it's good for you to know who you're going to need, who might need you, and play the long game. As I said, some of these people I've known for 15 or 18 years. And remember, help others and they will help you. Oh. You want to call tier 3, I'm gonna put it in system in terms. You want to call your friend in tier 3 and not go through tier 1. That's what you're shooting for here. And have a plan. So know your goals, know what your goals are, because they may not be the same as the other victims in your case, and they may not be the same as law enforcement. Build those relationships. now, because you never know when you're going to need them. Your pages could, you know, your phones could ring any minute. And also think about how much time, energy, and money are you and your organization willing to spend on handling a case like this. I know how much this one costs. It was worth every penny. And our VP and our CEO think it was worth every penny. But you have a plan, but how do you know how to plan? And that's where you have to have, you know, your criteria for success. What does it mean to be successful? And our entire organization, legal, management, tech, everybody, we were behind the single rallying cry. We are fighting for our gamers. Fighting for our gamers and the gameplay experience is so deeply encoded in the DNA at PlayStation that it has something to do with everything we do. Whether we're serving a developer or an artist or an online gamer, it's about the gameplay experience. And so everybody was rallied around, we're fighting for our gamers. And there's a positive correlation to how well your staff handles the incident to how well the investigation goes, because if you don't have the information, the FBI is not gonna have it. So, and the incredible sense of ownership, we put in a lot of hours on this. So we had a plan. We actually formulated this plan in the second week of the second round of DDoS. We put this together, and this went all the way up to the president of the company, and you'll see number one, protect the gameplay experience. That is what we were doing. These people were messing with our customers, they were messing with the people who want us to deliver content, and that's not acceptable. We also said, we don't want to just put a Band-Aid on this and go away. We're going to improve security across the board. Everything we learned, we're going to apply to every title that's also currently running and every title we do in the future, and it did. We're going to collect information to preserve options. We had no idea if we were ever going to be interested in prosecution. We didn't know if it would be possible, but we knew that we were going to preserve everything we could, and we were going to preserve it as if it was evidence, so chain of custody, and we were going to contribute to the community. So that's why I'm here, because this was one of the goals that we established in 2008. So it turns out that we showed this to the FBI, and they were like, wait, you had a plan? And then they got to number four, and they said, you're crazy. And then we said no, and here we are. But you know, this was everything we did. We could look back at this, and it helped guide us in how much time we spent and what we were looking at. So remain independent, never become an agent of the government. Mitnick and Heckenkamp, they both made claims that the investigators became agents of the government and the evidence should be tossed. That didn't happen. Be patient. Investigations take months, cases take years. Not all cases are going to get government resources. But your case may go nowhere, but it may lead to someone else that's really, really interesting. You're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. You never know when your minor case is going to give the big break somewhere else. And be kind. Everyone you're dealing with is under incredible stress, and be helpful, be kind, be empathetic. Everybody's doing the very best they can. And your case probably isn't just about hacking. In this case, one of the suspects was involved in making pipe bombs and exploding them in the woods behind his house next to the grade school. Another one made death threats against the president, and the third suspect was involved in industrial-grade credit card fraud. Log like you mean it. Log. If you didn't log it, it didn't happen. Learn a little about chain of evidence, but remember to retain this information and physical evidence. You're going to want digital evidence that leads to physical evidence that leads to something that you can explain to a jury. Truth. Three books and a movie can be made from a single case, and none of them will agree with each other or have any basis in reality. And truth is what you can help a jury understand. So this is, and finally, it's not all unicorn and rainbows. I have major disagreements. We've agreed to disagree about certain things. I'm really not happy about warrantless GPS tracking and national security letters, but we get through this, we work around this. This will be a culture change, and by the way, don't forget to support the EFF. So lessons for management, be patient, be available, give us some maneuverability, give us some room, and here are all the people who actually did all the work. I'm just doing the sharing. So thank you very much, and if you have any questions, great, and if not, I understand there's beer downstairs.